Good afternoon, and yes, happy Tuesday. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, our weekly gathering to discuss those things that matter most in our lives and the best ways to maintain our mental health and well-being. And just to keep things fresh and interesting, we're doing things a little differently this summer. Instead of coming to you live each week from the studio, I'm going to be bringing you stories from the road as I drive across the United States. So we won't be taking calls today, but you're always welcome to be a part of the program. You can like our Facebook page and find out about upcoming shows or see pictures from the road. You can also follow us on our new Instagram account, The Reluctant Therapist, which is following my progress across the country. And you can leave questions or comments or suggestions there. And also you can see photos of the people that I've interviewed and the places that I've talked about. You can also catch up with previous shows by visiting kcbx.org under the News Talk tab, or find our podcast through iTunes and subscribe to listen at your convenience and on your devices. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. No matter how you want to connect, you're always welcome to be a part of this conversation, and I'm always happy to hear from you and to have you share your thoughts about the show and some things that are going on in your life. So today, I'm in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Well, we actually started our journey from Denver, Colorado, and we drove north through Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is a wonderful cowboy town that I'm excited to go back and visit. We went through Cheyenne, Wyoming, and up into Custer, South Dakota. And it's amazing how quickly the skies open up and the road empties the further you travel up the road. It's just amazing to go across this wide expanse of flat open land, and then you see off in the distance these hills start to emerge. And the Black Hills are a magical, mystical place. You know, the obvious tourist draws are Mount Rushmore, which I have to say was surprisingly more majestic and awe-inspiring and beautiful than I'd hoped. It was much more than a drive-by monument. And other, you know, tourist attractions are Sturgis, with its overwhelming motorcycle presence, mainly Harley-Davidson's, drawing visitors all year round, and specifically in August when they have their huge event. But the Black Hills was much more than I expected. I mean, the beauty of the Black Hills, because it doesn't sound like it's going to be such a lush, water-filled, green, rolling hills type of beauty. I mean, that's what I didn't expect. There are a ton of hiking trails and biking trails and beautiful drives around every single turn. Especially the scenic Spearfish Canyon with waterfalls and gorgeous landscapes. It all is incredibly special. And you can feel the sacredness of the land. You know, this is the birthplace of the Lakota people, specifically a monument that I didn't know about until we got there, the Wind Cave National Monument or National Park. And this is the location where the first human beings were believed to have emerged from below the earth, according to the Lakota people. And right outside of the Black Hills is Devil's Tower. It's a monolithic butte, like a huge geologic wonder that arises out in the middle of the plains in the Bear Lodge Mountains of Wyoming. And it was actually the nation's first national monument and another sacred site for many Native American people. And Devil's Tower was also featured in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. If you're a science fiction person, you'll know what I'm referring to. But it's interesting because there was so much more to it. We could have spent days and days, but we ended up camping for 3 nights there. Clear skies, cool nights, incredible lakes and streams. This was a place that I'd always wanted to see, and it was way more than I ever imagined. It's I don't know, in all of these places around the Black Hills, not only was the scenery incredible, but I had great conversations with all sorts of unique individuals, people drawn to the Black Hills for many different reasons, either as visitors or as people who have come there to become permanent residents. So I'm really excited to share with you these three conversations that I had with three very special men, an artist, a politician, and a street musician. They each have very different life experiences and very different life perspectives. And each of their stories, though, have an interesting connection to each other. You know, they have a connection to the importance of sustaining our mental health and well-being and how we can find our true authenticity and peace if we keep believing in who we are. And the other thing that was interesting about these conversations was, although they are each so different, they did share this common theme of wanting to find their truth and also being very devoted and committed to their families. So I am thrilled to start our conversations today with my very first guest, Eric Sutton. So today I am in Hill City, South Dakota. We spent the morning touring Mount Rushmore, which was incredibly moving and overwhelming. And so we kind of wandered along the road and came upon a sculpture show, Sculpture in the Hills, here in Hill City. And wandering through the tent, talking to the artist, I came upon a gentleman whose work is, well, it stopped my husband first because it's functional art. It was furniture art, and he was completely drawn to it. And then as we started talking, I was looking at pictures of this artist's work, and I said, oh, you should use this picture. You should dress like you are in this picture while you're showing your pieces at sculpture shows. And he said, well, that's actually from the Patagonia catalog. Actually, I'm a climber by first love and an artist. And I said, we need to talk. Mm-hmm. So Eric Sutton, thank you for stepping away from the art show to speak with me for a little bit this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you. It's an honor, actually.
So I love how things fall into place. But can you start off talking a little bit about your journey to becoming an artist and showing at a place like Sculpture in the Hills, and how climbing fits into that?
I've been a climber for a long time, and I would work construction. I lived out of my car when I was younger, traveling around climbing, and then I'd have jobs that I'd go back to and do construction work. And it just gradually worked into building finer and finer stuff and furniture. And I started just in the last probably 4 years just going with real high-end type stuff. When the economy took a dump.
That's an odd. So as soon as the economy went down, you decided to charge more for your work or to do more expensive pieces? How come?
Well, you know, the people who have money mm-hmm. aren't affected by the economy so much. And I was either going to have this work or do something else. And so it worked for a number of years where I was doing real high-end furniture. And I'd be lined out for a year, 8 months, or a year at a time with work. And then the economy started doing better, and I stopped being lined out as far. And I tried a different kind of business model. I'm not very conventional in many things, and I had a lot of people telling me I should try doing. I've got a folding mechanism on a chair that I got a patent on, and it. I usually do one of a kinds, but these were things that I could more mass produce. They're still done all individually, mm-hmm. and all real good quality construction, and I do every part myself.
So I'm feeling the Renaissance man in you, because I wanted you to start a little bit about how you were born in California, you said, and yeah. were on the East Coast, and started. Did you start climbing on the East Coast?
Yeah, I started climbing in Western Massachusetts.
And then what brought you, you know, across the country? Because something drew you to this area. And was it just climbing?
Climbing and hopping in a car before cell phones and not being reachable and taking off with, you know, if I had $1,000 in my pocket back then, I could go a long ways. Gas was $1 a gallon. So I would go straight through. I mean, I drive straight through 36 hours from New England to Colorado or to here, and then just head west. I didn't have any definite plans. I was just going to go climb.
And I'm assuming you're not making a living climbing, right? So you're making money in construction and then spending the money climbing. And what did the climbing bring for you? And what kind of climbing are you talking about?
Well, I did make some money at climbing, but I didn't. I intentionally didn't make my passion my living.
Okay.
So I was doing instructor trainer courses with friends who would line them up, but I mostly just climbed just for the enjoyment of it. And I was doing I got pretty good pretty quick. But it was a lot of it had to do with. You know, it was a great place to channel my angst.
And so how did you first get introduced to climbing? I mean, were you always, did your family do this? I mean, how do you get introduced in Western Massachusetts to something like climbing?
Well, I loved the mountains. My dad grew up in Southern California going backpacking in the Sierras all the time. And I went backpacking with him in the mountains and loved the mountains. And so climbing was just kind of a natural extension of that. And I got the opportunity, the college I was going to in Massachusetts, I was an engineering major. And because I understood engineering real good with math and science and stuff, but I didn't necessarily want to be an engineer. It just made more sense. And then at that school, there was one of the first outdoor leadership programs in the country. And so I got accepted into that, and that's where I started climbing.
And so, years climbing, and then when does the artist in you awaken? You know, because you said you're doing construction, and you're climbing, and then when do you discover, oh, and I'm amazing at constructing beautiful pieces of art?
The climbing is artful, too.
True.
And the lifestyle was artful, and so I don't see them separated, really. I was talking to somebody else earlier that the truth that nobody gets to hear about stuff is what interests me, like what has really happened in history compared to what we've learned in books, what's really going on with people. So a linear society, everything's a defined line.
Yes.
Nothing in the universe is linear. Everything's cyclical. So everything's a circle or a spiral. And so if you're seeing things as a line, you're seeing a very tiny part of the circle, and you're missing out on the rest. That's the struggle I wind up dealing with in this society a lot, is being surrounded by people who only see the line, and I get exposed to and see some of the rest of the arc.
Let's talk about how, you know, because an artist's lens of the world is different. And let's talk a little more about, you know, if you are looking at history, for example, can you give an example of something that we might have been told as a linear story that you would see in a different way?
That civilization has only been 5,000 or 6,000 years old. If you've ever heard of the supposedly the oldest story in the world, the Epic of Gilgamesh, that was a handful of clay cuneiform tablets found. This is pre-Babylon. Mm-hmm. They found thousands of those. And the only thing that's publicly translated is the Epic of Gilgamesh. There were about 100 people who were able to translate those tablets. And, you know, public doesn't know much of anything about them. And it's a totally different version of history.
I don't even know what the Epic of Gilgamesh is. Can you give me the short history answer?
The short history answer is that it's a king. Mm-hmm. Who is, you hear all these Roman and Greek myths about people like Hercules, who are half man, half god. And if you look at that stuff from a standpoint of what we know now with genetic manipulation, it's really not so far-fetched that there could be other beings, you know, doing that kind of stuff. And the Epic of Gilgamesh is very clear about that having happened. Hmm. Very clear. Talking about the, you know, the gods, not from, so the first thing that I had to do with studying this stuff is realize that what I already know is the wrong context for learning something new. Mm-hmm. So I have to try and understand the cultural context of something else before I can make any sense of studying it.
And so what is the story that culture is trying to sell us? Right, we have to understand what the myth is that we're all living before we can understand the story outside of our myth.
The myth would be that there's never been anything but Western civilization.
So how did you get interested in what do you call this study that you got involved in?
Consciousness study, basically. I mean, there's terms like archaeoastronomy that's a fairly new multidisciplinary science that I go to conferences about. But it's consciousness, life, has got so much more to it than our culture really pays attention to.
So if you didn't have the outlet of art or climbing or studying alternative consciousness or consciousness in general, what would your life be like, or what would you be like?
I'd have found something else.
So do you think you were just destined to always be a questioner?
It's what I do.
Well, because I always think about it from the mental health perspective, right? And how the things that we choose to do, how it either serves our mental health or hurts us in the long run, right? And so there's a lot of feeling that what people are doing right now is not aiding their mental health in any way. And in many ways, we live too quickly and too scatteredly and too unconsciously. And that's one of the reasons why our mental health suffers. So I wonder, do you feel that you've found a way of grounding your mental health in a positive way through your life?
So I had to pick if I was going to squash myself along with the culture, or if I was going to let myself be the way I am, and lots of times being surrounded by people I can't relate to and can't relate to me. Mm-hmm. I think it's crazy you're doing the first one.
So what is life like in South Dakota? Because you've been exposed to life on the East Coast, life on the West Coast. What is South Dakota like for you?
It's wide open. It's the way the planet, more the way the planet was made without man remaking it.
So do you find yourself in South Dakota more who you always should have been?
If you ask my mom, I've always been pretty damn strong-willed. So I think it would have happened one way or another anyway. And these are the ways that I've been doing it so far. But I mean, I've broken 30 bones in my life. I'm getting kind of beat up for doing some of the stuff I do. So I still do it, but to a lesser degree. But, you know, my body's kind of trashed. It may not seem like it, but I'm pretty trashed. And so I'm going to studying stuff and a passion there, and then doing the other physical stuff less extremely.
And so early on you mentioned that you're a dad first. Yeah. So what is it you are hoping to model or pass along to your children?
Well, I bring them to the conferences with me. They were the first kids ever to be to these conferences, these CPAC conferences. I need to earn their respect every day. That's the way I try to raise my kids. And then they hopefully will get a whole lot from that, which, I mean, I'm so damn proud of them.
How old are your kids?
Almost 23 and almost 14. So two different moms. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell them they're half-sisters because they aren't.
And so you got emotional when you were talking about earning their respect every day. So what have they brought to your life being a father? Because clearly that was a huge transition from solo journeyer climber to dad first.
Yeah, I always wanted to be a dad. I got recruited pretty hard for armed forces, and it specifically special forces, which is, you know, I mean, being an assassin. is what a lot of that is. I didn't see that mixing very well with being a dad. And I wound up developing a lot of those sides of myself with really extreme, bold rock climbing. Mm-hmm. But without, trashing my conscience.
Right. Or taking another life. Maybe just your own, if you did one false step, right?
Yeah.
So Eric Sutton, artist, Renaissance man, climber, dad first. I appreciate you taking the time today outside here, Sculpture in the Hills in Hill City, South Dakota. And if people wanted to get more involved in the pieces that you're creating, how can they find you in your work?
My website is behindthetimesfurniture.com.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to Public Radio KCBX. And you might notice that we're doing things a little differently today. We're not taking calls, but instead, I'm sharing with you stories from the road as I drive across the United States. You can still be part of the conversation through our Facebook page or follow us on our new Instagram account through The Reluctant Therapist. You can see photos of the people that I've talked to and the places that I'm talking about. And you can always send me an email to Elizabeth@TheReluctantTherapist.com. But today, I'm sharing with you three very different men with three very different life perspectives. And this common theme between all of these stories about finding your own inherent gifts while staying focused and committed to yourself and your family. We've just heard from artist, climber, philosopher, and father Eric Sutton. And now we transition a bit to my second conversation, and this took place in Custer State Park alongside Center Lake. And to be honest, you know, I thought about this interview because I had such a great time talking to this individual that I thought I can do a whole show with these stories and this wisdom and these quips. But I really wanted to make this interview part of these three very different stories to kind of tie together this common idea that even if we come from completely unique and different backgrounds, at the heart of it in our life, we share very common and connected desires. So I can't think of a more beautiful place to share the life philosophies and hopes for the future. And I can't think of a better person to hear some of these nuggets of wisdom about life philosophies and hope for the future than from my next guest, father, grandfather, husband, teacher, tool and die maker, and city councilman from Louisville, Kentucky, my guest, Stuart Benson. This morning, I've woken up at Center Lake in the middle of Custer State Forest or State Park. And we're still in South Dakota working our way towards Nebraska. And this morning in our beautiful campground, we had a great night's sleep in the back of our flex and our camper setup, which has worked really well. My husband was meandering through the campground and struck up a conversation with one of our fellow campers. And it turns out that our neighbor, Stuart Benson, is traveling from his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, towards the west, going the opposite direction that we are. And Stuart Benson happens to be a city council member in Louisville, Kentucky. There are 26 city council members in Louisville, and each of them represents about 30,000 people. And Stuart has served for four terms and is looking towards a fifth term in the fall, running unopposed. So he must be doing a great job representing his people. And so, Stuart, I'm so glad you sat down with me for a few minutes. I'd love to know what is life like in Louisville for you? What do you do aside from being a city council member, and what drew you into politics?
Well, I used to be a school teacher. I started my life off at a company called General Electric, trained me to be a tool and die maker, and really loved making things. But a job came open to teach vocational education, and I thought, and I went to a vocational school when I was in high school, and I thought, boy, it'd be great to teach kids like myself who were struggling to figure out where you want to go, and help them have a direction. And so. I'm retired from teaching school now. And I ran for Metro Council because of we merged our city and county together. I felt there's two things really important, to create jobs and to help people navigate government. It felt like every time I had problems with government, it seemed like everybody in government was doing you a favor to help you. I think if you're supposed to be helping people, then you ought to act like you want to help them. And so I'm retired from teaching school, like I said, and this is my fifth. This will be my fifth term. I just like helping people who feel helpless, mm-hmm. to give them empowerment that somebody in government cares. Our city is no different than most cities. We're going through sewer issues of, you know, we never even treated sewage until 1959. All of our sewage went right in a river. And so you're trying to balance out how to spend the money and use it most effectively. And affordable housing is a big issue, which it kind of breaks my heart when somebody doesn't have a place to live. You want to help those people, but you really want to say, why aren't we training people so they can get their own job and live anywhere they want?
So what is life like in Louisville? What is the life of a resident like?
For me personally, my parents come from Iowa. My grandparents come from Norway and Sweden. I'm glad my dad during the war came to Louisville. To me, it's the greatest town. I mean, we got all kinds of activities and stuff. It's a family. It's a family town where you want to raise a family. That you walk down the street and you see somebody and you say, "Hi, how you doing?" And you don't know them. You say, "How you doing?" And there's some places you go in the world that you say that and they'll think, "What are you trying to do? You're going to attack me?" Or I don't know. And so the southern portion of our we've taken on southern hospitality by being even north, but. It's just, it's a great, I've been a lot of places. I've been to, my wife's family's from Switzerland and Holland and visit them and enjoy that. Boy, our way of life is so much better. I mean, you walk away from, you go there and you come home, you think, you get down on the ground and kiss it, say, "Thank you, God. Thank you for allowing me, my family, to live in this country and live in Louisville, Kentucky." Mm-hmm.
So you joined the city council, and it sounds like your vocational training and getting people an opportunity to have a job where they can make money to buy a home, like those simple life opportunities are all important to you. So what are the opportunities like in Louisville? I mean, one of the problems we have on the West Coast is you can find a great job, but you still can't afford housing. Can you carve out a nice life in Louisville with the work that's there?
I put over 500 students on jobs. And looking back, though, that's probably my greatest achievement, helping kids who sometimes people think are not, they want to say college material. I think everybody's college material. Some people just don't want to go. So in 28 years, I don't know if I've only had about two or three kids who was dumber than me. And so they're all capable. You just have to give them a direction. And it's unbelievable how much a person can achieve when they know where the goal is. My daughter, when she was in the fifth grade, I asked her, I said, "What do you like to be when you get older?" And she says, "I don't know." I said, "Well, that's what most people say, I don't know. Let's start thinking about that." And after about 2 weeks, she told me she wanted to be an astronaut. I said, "Oh, great, because I want to be a tool and die maker. Because, I know I can get her a job, and my girls are hand-eye coordination. They're intelligent." Well, when she was 15 years old, I said, "Would you be a good astronaut if you didn't like flying? Let's take a flying lesson," thinking that she'll get sick and won't like it. Well, she gets out of the airplane and says, "You're right, Dad, I don't want to be an astronaut. I'm going to be a pilot." So we bought an airplane. And then so here she is, before she even driver's license, she's flying an airplane. And my middle daughter said, "Well, Dad, she's the only one get to fly?" I said, "No, everybody can fly. I mean, I don't care about flying." So they flew this airplane with requirements. Every time you take off, you got to do four or five touch and goes, because everybody can take an airplane off. The secret is landing it and doing it automatically when you have a problem. And so then and when she was about 20 years old, she had all of her licenses and she started a flight school. But it all starts from having an opportunity to do what you like. You find a person who likes what they're doing and how much better their life and everybody's life around them is. And so I just, it hurts me to see so much talent in our country being wasted with nobody knowing where they're going.
So then what's missing? Is it an educational issue? Is it a parenting issue? Is it a government issue? I mean, how do we help young people discover their talents, but at the same time, the practicality of having to put a roof over our head, mm-hmm. right? Or if the jobs aren't there, I mean, is it just as simple as finding what you like doing, or is it really about trying to subsist?
Well, when you find they're in your interest, there could be 15 or 20 jobs in where your interest is. Say you like working with the soil. You might be a farmer. You might be a horticulture. Who knows? A person who likes to help people who are sick. They could be emptying a bedpan, or they could be a doctor. I mean, way we approach our education in Holland, they work from first to seventh grade, finding your interest, and after that, say, here's all the jobs it lines up with your interest. It's not just a flute. It's not like taking an AVAS test and one day you say, oh, here's what I need to be. Well, I don't know if I agree with that, and so. My problem is with most people who are educated, they want everybody to be go through the way they've went through. That's all they see. A teacher says, you ought to be a teacher. You ought to go to school. And they don't know what the real world's about. You know, every time somebody makes something, how many, you know, as a toolmaker, we was taught that we don't run away from problems, run towards them. Because if you make something, a ballpoint pen, a cup, whatever, somebody needs that and somebody's going to buy it. Then somebody's going to sell it and somebody's going to deliver it, you know, just a job creation. And so my kind of thing is trying to help people find their way in this world.
So it's interesting because one of the turning points in American economies was the opening of Frank Parsons guidance counseling centers in upstate New York in the early 1900s. And it was a revolutionary idea that they would ask young men what it is they wanted to do instead of saying, you'll do what your father did.
Right.
And then we had these vocational centers around the country. Mm-hmm. And then they went away after World War II when we started focusing on educating, as you said, in one manner, that everyone would go into some sort of manufacturing job, right? Something that pushed the economy forward. So do you think we need to go back to this idea of vocational guidance, where we actually spend part of our educational money in vocational guidance?
Well, when you think how much knowledge there is in the world, and we're going to make somebody well-rounded, you know, that old saying, jack of all trades and skilled in none, you have everybody, you know, when a kid gets out of school, in my view, and you can't get a job, school didn't help him out. Everybody has to produce. Most people want to be have self-esteem on the value of who they are. And I'm not very well educated, but I can take my tools. I can go any place in the country and I can get a job. I'm 67 years old and somebody like me shouldn't be able to get a job over, but there's just not that many. We just elected a new governor, Matt Bevins. And he's got a lot of companies throughout the country. And when he found out I was a tool and die maker, he said, would you want be willing to work for me part-time or something? He said, can't hire nobody. And I said, boy, that's just a shame. Because all the students I ever put on jobs, they're making big bucks. And when I tell people, I said, you know, valedictorians in high schools and stuff, and how much the elite kids of education and my students make as much or more than they do.
So in education, because I hear what you're saying, and I think a lot of people are having the same questions. Yes, everyone may be college able, but is that going to put them where they need to be to have the quality of life they want? Maybe we need to start opening young people's eyes to all the ways we can make a living. You know, my father also talks about, you know, the people who are going to be the wealthiest in the next generation are those that can fix the things that get broken, because no one can fix anything anymore. Mm-hmm. How do we switch that mindset to value once again work with our hands?
Well, when the school system has people who've been... I think school is a business. I know everybody doesn't believe that. But we spend more and more money every year on education, and the results are the same. They get worse. And you know, Einstein said, you know, keep doing the same thing the same way and expect something different, it's insanity. Well, I think that's what it is. But unless somebody gets on the other side and changes those people, I don't know. You were talking about people who have problems and... They do have problems. And what they're looking for is, if you know somebody's got a problem, they're telling you, I need some help. Could you listen to me a little bit? And sometimes I used to always tell my students, the easiest way to solve a problem is share it with somebody you trust. It's surprising. Just telling them, you might even discover the solution while you're telling. It's unbelievable. When it comes out your mouth and goes back in your ear, the process is different.
You just described therapy, and that's exactly how a therapist works, is allowing someone the opportunity to tell their story in confidence in a safe and private place. And when they hear the words coming out of their head or hear them reflected back, they go, oh, I know what I need to do. Yeah. And they're ready to move along, well, right? Giving voice to the problem.
There was an old toolmaker I worked with, and he used to talk to himself all the time. And some guys would kind of make fun of him. And I asked him one day, I said, why do you do that? He said, listen, if you're doing a job, you say, well, how should I do this job? And if you come up with, I don't know, that means you need help. He said, most people quit because they get frustrated. He said, eliminate the frustration. You know, Edison made the light bulb 1,001 times. How come he didn't quit after 50 or 500? Well, he found success in his failures. And I used to always tell my students, you know, if I walk up to you and I say, what are you doing? He said, I'm thinking, well, how long will you be here? Well, I don't know. What do you mean? I said, well, there'll be a time when you become frustrated and you'll quit. And so you got to realize you don't know, so you need help. It could be a book, it could be me, it could be another student, it could be anybody. And you search for a solution to get the job done. And that means you're always looking for new thoughts.
And I love your passion because it's infectious. I mean, we want people, from what I'm hearing, we want people to feel excited about their lives, and what they're doing with their day to day can help them be excited. Because we hear so much about meaningless work or the drudgery of work or working in a cubicle, kind of going through our lives numbed out. And the way you talk about work is if you could get up and start at 6 a.m. and go all night long because you're just excited and you want that for other people.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that I used to tell my students. I always have stories. But Edison came in from working in his lab all night and sat down, and his wife's fixing his breakfast, and said, Tom, you need to take a vacation. He said, really? He said, what do you think I should do? He said, I think y'all do anything you want to because you deserved it. He said, okay. And he finishes up his breakfast and he starts out the door, and she said, where are you going? She says, I'm starting my vacation. He's going back to the lab. He loved it, you know. And so if you think about what is time when you're doing what you like doing? You watch kids who are playing ball sometimes. They just can't quit. Well, they love it.
And so let's shift gears just a little bit, because you talked with such love about your children and your grandchildren. What is the role of grandparents? You know, because we're so spread out, right? People's lives are so busy and compartmentalized. What is it? What is your goal as a grandfather with these kids?
Well, for me personally, I want them all to go to heaven. And so I work on all of my grandkids, and they're all going to heaven. And everybody I run across to, I almost sometime will mention, you know, our Constitution was made up to say everybody has a free will to believe whatever they want to. That's precious. You can, even when you're wrong, you can believe what you want to. But, you know, my God says, you know, if you look for the truth, you'll come to him. And no matter what you believe, you'll come to him. And that's amazing. And so to me, I'm always wanting my grandkids to feel comfortable who they are. My mother made me feel that I didn't have to be the greatest. The only thing I had to do, the best I could. And that freed me up. Only thing I got to do is do the best I can.
So maybe, you know, the grandparents' role is just to love on those kids.
Yes,
without expectations.
Yeah, well, but with some guidance, you know, if nobody ever takes time to say, where are you going, then how can you get there?
Mm-hmm. And any final thoughts, any final nugget you would like to share? If you could have the world's stage for 30 seconds, what would you want them to know?
God loves them. And he wants to know, have everybody have a chance to know how he loves them. And so I think that's probably the thing we're kind of missing a little bit in our country. Caring for, you know, you love your neighbor as thyself, you know. And so, you know, that's what God wants us to do. And that's the easiest way to spread the word, is when somebody trusts you and you can feed him. And when they're hungry or they need a coat when they're cold, you help them.
And it gets no better than that, doesn't it? I mean, we can be a million miles apart politically, spiritually, or culturally, but if we just help each other out, it's that simple. Wouldn't the world be a better place? Human-to-human care, just seeing someone in need and offering a hand? I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and if you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist on Public Radio KCBX. I'm coming to you from the road this summer. I'm actually driving across the United States, part of the way with my husband, and the rest of the way I'll be solo. So I'll be sharing with you stories of individuals that I meet along the way. And today, we're in the Black Hills of South Dakota, talking with three very different men with unique life stories and perspectives, connected by a strong sense of right makes right, and that family is our base. My first guest was artist Eric Sutton, and we just heard from Stuart Benson, city councilman from Louisville, Kentucky, fellow camper and traveler. And as we finish up the show today, we're going to be speaking with a street musician. And as I'm sure you'll hear, the very first thing that draws you to Stephen Thorpe is his voice. It's haunting, it's compelling, it's warm, and it's honest. And I was exploring the streets of, you know, as I was exploring the streets of Hill City, And in honesty, it's a long main street. There aren't a lot of streets. Most of the towns here are very, very small. But as I was walking Main Street, I couldn't help but be drawn to the energetic, kind of this vibrant presence gathering around this street artist, the street musician. And every time he started to sing, more people would gather. And of course, I was drawn also. So I first walked up and stopped to listen, you know, to a song or two, just with the intention of, you know, hearing his music. But I couldn't leave because he would start telling stories between the songs. And so his wonderful storytelling skills and his journey to becoming a musician on Main Street in Hill City, South Dakota, which, to be honest, is a really tough gig because on this main street of Hill City, you're competing with the ever-present rumble of Harley Davidson's rolling through this town, which you'll be able to hear in the background of our conversation. But really, in the end, it's the voice of Steve Thorpe that will arise most clearly from this conversation. And so I happily introduce you to the gift that is Steve Thorpe. We're on the streets of Hill City, South Dakota, and we've come upon Steve Thorpe, musician, playing his original songs for the people as they pass by.
All right, this is one I wrote for my son, who's a surfer and a fireman in Santa Cruz, California.
There you go.
Where are you from?
We're from San Luis Obispo, California.
I've been there. Take ye care across the mountain, take ye care across the sea, take ye care where'er you wander, may your road return to me.
First, I'm going to ask, because no one can see you, how old are you, Steve Tharp?
72.
All right. And so when did you enlist in the Army by choice, or were you drafted? I'm not doing my history well.
Well, it's odd. I enlisted.
Okay.
But I enlisted because I was drafted. And it seemed the more sensible thing to do. I knew about the language school in Monterey, so I enlisted before in the Army Security Agency. I've got 2 years of Chinese Mandarin. They sent me to Okinawa for 2 years. Gave me a job that allowed me to forget it. And quite frankly, the Army, all of my life after, comes right out of that. Because when I got out, I said to myself, I am never going to do anything remotely like that again, ever in this life.
So the time in the military didn't serve the artist soul that lives inside you, I imagine.
Can I be frank?
Yeah, please. That's what we're here to do.
It showed me a lot of bullshit. I considered that 4 years I was seeing the soft underbelly of democracy, and I didn't like it. You know, I mean, everything I'd been taught about this country, it was a lie. And I just, when I got out, I decided, screw it, I'm not doing that again. So I didn't. I spent 20 years writing novels.
Did you really?
I took the GI Bill. I got a BA or a MA in creative writing at UC Davis. Rather than get a job, my ex-wife was a career woman. When we got pregnant, she was really depressed that she was going to have to quit and stay home and take care of the baby. And I was really depressed that I was going to have to go out and get some stupid job. And finally I said, what if I stayed home and took care of the baby? And she said, would you do that? And I said, well, yeah. I can take care of the baby and write while he sleeps. You know. And actually that was a wonderful time in my life. I mean, until I actually got into the folk singing thing, got away with it.
What years were was this? I think you're pre-feminist movement, right? What years were you doing this?
Yeah, this is funny. This was real early. I got out in 1970. Richard was born in 72, so it was just the beginning. And I mean, she was in these consciousness raising sessions. You know, the women had all come to the house, and I had to get out of there. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I wasn't even allowed to hear what was going on, but I was taking care of the kid. You know, I mean, I kind of felt like I was involved in the movement in a very tangential way, but I was loving it. I mean, you know, I start out, she goes back to work. He's 2 weeks old. I'm holding this thing. I got his head in one hand. I've got his butt in the other hand, and the hands are almost touching. And I'm like, man, you got to eat. You know, I mean, one head cold and you're toast. I loved it. And all this time I'm thinking, women don't want to do this? Why not? You know, I mean, this is fun. This is you get to see a human being develop from you know, the tabula rasa, though it's not actually rasa, but it's, you know, from coming into the world and that look in the eyes, seeing, you know, when a human being sees something for the first time, I loved it. And all through that I was writing. I started thinking about this, and of course at the same time I'm a Vietnam era veteran. I wasn't in Vietnam, but so I'm thinking about, okay, there's a story in this guy and a kid thing, right? And I'm still all full of anger about what I had to do for my country. One day, there was a woman who was doing ironing for us. One day, she comes in, and I wore my fatigue shirts. I mean, the classic costume for a vet in those days at UC Davis was jeans, combat boots, and a fatigue shirt. And they'd see us, you know, and it was, we were a threat to people. I mean, a bunch of us would get together, we'd go have lunch sitting on the quad, and people would give us a wide berth, like, you know, and none of us had been in combat. But it was just the whole attitude, you know, and so we kind of played with that a little bit. But anyway, this woman comes to pick up the laundry, and I had a fatigue shirt. I dropped an ash on it and burned a hole in it. And I opened the door, and she looks at me. She says, "Oh, were you in Vietnam?" And I says, "Yeah, I took a tracer right here." Yeah, and the look on that woman's face, she swallowed that. I mean, whole. And I suddenly realized that nobody understood that war. You know, I mean, you could say anything about it. And people, and I'm like, whoa, there's a lot of fictional ground here. So I started this novel. I called it The Dead Man and the Kid novel. It was about a veteran who was not a combat vet. He'd been wounded in a training accident. He had post-traumatic amnesia. Mm-hmm. He couldn't remember what happened. So the whole story is, it starts here outside Custer, South Dakota. He and a combat vet whose legs has lost both legs are kind of holed up in a cabin, just hiding out from civilization. You know, they're angry. They want to be isolated because nobody understands. And they get hauled back into real life because Sherwood, the main character's sister, dies, leaves his child. So they go back to California to take care of him. And it's the novel's about all three of them putting themselves back together. They call it a novel of recovery. It was published by Doubleday, and then in 85 for the 10th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, they published it, Bantam published it.
Wow.
And, I mean, that all came out of raising the kid. You know, I mean, it was all, you know, that relationship. So I thought I was going to have a career as a novelist, and of course I didn't. Yeah, I mean.
But maybe I misheard that you wrote 20 novels, though?
Actually, I think it was 13. Somewhere between 13 and 18. It's been so long, I don't remember. I've got the manuscript boxes sitting in my apartment in Lead, but, you know, I mean, I've got them because there are some that when the music goes away, I'll probably go back to and see if I can make publishable. But, yeah, I doubt I can. You know what I mean?
So writing didn't become your full-time career, and you were home raising your son for a while, writing. When did things shift? How long were you in California? When did you transition to this? Because I imagine there's a lot of life between Davis Master's program and playing on the streets of Hill City.
I needed to change. I mean, I knew I needed to change. I was changing in a lot of ways. I'd been an atheist all my life. I was starting to feel this spiritual pull. So I packed up and left, and I came out here, got to the hills, and basically I was done. I mean, I got out of my old scout over at the family cabin over in Spearfish Canyon, threw my arms to the sky, and I said, all right, I'm finished. You know, I did a lot of things I thought I wanted to do. Some of them worked out, some of them didn't, but I'm done with them. You know, I did a whole lot of things I didn't want to do. Some of them were crap, and you know, some of them worked out really well. But I'm finished. I'm done with all that. What am I supposed to do? Show me and I'll do it. And after that, I just sat there and listened. You know, started getting the cabin fixed up so I could spend a winter. Nobody had ever spent a winter in it before. You know, I mean, it was quite a winter.
So how long did you allow yourself, or how long did this period last?
I don't think I'm done with it yet, really. I mean, in a lot of ways. What happened was, I mean, I had come out here with the stated intention of making it as a writer or starving to death.
Okay.
All right, well, I had a really good friend in Newcastle, Wyoming, who had a restaurant. And he hired me to sing in his restaurant. Well, I had, when we got to this, I had a dozen songs, which is just enough to fill up a 45-minute set. So I'd play a 45-minute set, and then I'd take a break until everybody left, and then I'd wait till it filled up again, and I'd play the same set, you know. And slowly, as this went on, I figured out that, I mean, okay, I'm playing things that nobody's ever heard before. So they're not going to recognize them the second time anyway. All I have to do is mix up the list. And having that forum to present songs was a tremendous impetus to write more. And I mean, there was a period there I was writing 4 or 5 songs a week. I mean, it was this torrent. I mean, I'd always said when I was in grad school that in writing, I mean, you got all this cultural bullshit, and you've got to write all that out of your soul to get to the good stuff. And basically what happened was when I got all that written out, what I ended up with was songs. And I'm really happy with it. I've got 3 CDs. Most of them are originals. I do a few covers of other Black Hills songwriters, and I'm just finishing up another one. I'm going to have 20 original songs to pick for, and I'll put 17 on it.
So do you think that the Black Hills could be like a Nashville or, you know, the Appalachians? Like, is there a sound that is connected to the Black Hills that would make it its own unique genre?
I don't think you can have that now. With mass communication, I don't think a unique sound's possible. You know, everybody is influenced by the radio. I'm a folkie. We've got rap people. We've got Lakota. There's a young Lakota band in town now, just back from a tour of Japan. The Cody Blackbird band. I mean, this is a real American music, and it's happening all over the country. I mean, go up to the Fox and Goose in Sacramento, to the open mic they've got there, and see what you've got. You know, I mean, it's happening everywhere.
Steve Thorpe, thank you for your time. Will you leave us with another song?
Yeah.
You got anything ruminating in there?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's see here.
And this has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And today we brought you three conversations with individuals from the Black Hills of South Dakota. And I look forward to bringing you more stories from different parts of the country next week and on into the summer as I work my way across the United States. And although we aren't taking calls, we always like to hear from you. So you can be part of this conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Or you can follow our journey on our Facebook page or on Instagram through The Reluctant Therapist. And you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. And you can podcast our shows by going to iTunes or your podcast app. As always, I appreciate you supporting Public Radio KCBX. And I leave you today with the sounds of street musician Steve Thorpe from the Black Hills of South Dakota.
It was early in the morning, I heard the rainbows fall. Big boys cut them down again, you know, this time they think they got them all. Then they went down to the courthouse to celebrate their win. Someone invited me along, but when I got there, they would not let me in. Now that piece of moon is sliding like an orange slice down the sky. I know I won't catch up tonight, I'll get it by and by. Every dog must have his day, I hope mine's coming soon. Big boys cut the rainbows down, I'm chasing the moon. Now how the big boys got the leprechauns is a story seldom told. It was a sneak attack at midnight, smashed the pots, made off with the gold. Then they got out their chainsaws, sharpened them all night, then attacked the rainbows in the early morning light. Now that piece of moon is sliding like an orange slice down the sky. No, I won't catch up tonight, I'll get it by and by. Everyone must have a day, I hope mine's coming soon. Big boys cut the rainbows down, I'm chasing the moon. Now when Dorothy hit the big stage, Toto toted up the score. Country they were singing wasn't Kansas anymore. So he bought an ukulele, went hanging out in bars, and he sang a song to trees and rocks and nighttime to the stars. Now that piece of moon is sliding like an orange slice down the sky. He knows he won't catch up tonight, he'll get it by and by. Every dog.